It is time now to bring in David Terechuk and the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning, and we take a look at the stories media is covering and how the media is covering those stories. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we do have, once again, a lot to talk about, especially with the media and what's going on in Ukraine. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. I'm glad to be reporting in from the media capital of the world again, New York City, and joining again the ever-incisive Marshall Miles. Yes, the war in Ukraine is dominating the airwaves. I guess one inescapable truth about war is that it can bring out the very worst in the media, and there's lots of it, lots of the worst, I mean. But war can often bring out the best. And I don't want to strike an unwelcome note right from the beginning, of a note of bad taste among the grimness of this Ukraine war. But I do want to sound our occasional fanfare for some of the good journalism that's been provoked by the dark events in Ukraine. Can we hear it?
Absolutely. Hang on a second here. We'll bring it up here in a second. Just got to click the right button here. All right, here we go. Now we've got it. Now I'm wondering why my computer is doing this, David. It's one of those things that that happens in the media quite frequently. That's why
YouTube. Your computer doesn't want us to do this.
No. There we go. There we go.
Bold and brave fanfare. Thanks for playing it. It's a fanfare this week shared by a broad group of media outlets. I'm not singling out any one individual. I want to hear it for the category I best describe as other countries' public radio networks. No disrespect for our own NPR, because it's been doing a pretty good job in Ukraine, moving some of its best correspondents from their home bases, like Eleanor Beardsley of Paris, Joanna Kikistis from Athens, Daniel Estrin from Jerusalem, into the theater of war in Eastern Europe. But it's certainly helpful, I think, to take a prolonged listen and look at the public output from Europe itself when it comes to a war so deeply rooted in that region itself, though, of course, with worldwide dimensions too. On these Robin Hood radio airwaves of ours, when I've been asked for recommendations, and in my online column too, I've often recommended Deutsche Welle, the German international broadcasting service. Literally, it means German wave, as in airwaves. But we non-German speakers can take in its output in English, I'm glad to say. Let's state the obvious. Deutsche Welle's perspective is unquestionably, inevitably European, and all the more helpful for that, I think. I would stick, this is my advice, I would stick to Deutsche Welle's verbal output, the material written on the webpage or spoken on the air by its seasoned reporters, the analysts, and the newsmakers too themselves, who include many leaders and policymakers that appear on Deutsche Welle. On the TV side, I have to caution that it does fall foul of the usual problem that afflicts all 24-hour video news services, whatever language they're in, whatever country they're coming from. Actual video coverage from the field in this war is still a relatively sparse commodity, and it's too often just being looped and repeated ad nauseam. You know the pattern. And it often ends up as a backdrop, not always just a backdrop, not always a directly relevant backdrop either to discussion segments. So with Deutsche Welle, I would check in occasionally on the visual side of our output, but don't stay there. Go to the audio side or the written side, the written on screen side. There's great reporting and really important. And from Britain, no longer in Europe politically, but geographically, Britain still obviously is in Europe. And from there comes the renowned BBC World Service. And in this war, the World Service is living up to its name, serving the world. Indeed, in its promotional material, it's getting a little bit of grandiosity creeping in, which doesn't really go well with its traditional British reserve. But I guess that's in the nature of promotional material. We all do it, I guess, exaggerate while we're touting our own wares. But the BBC World Service announcers are nowadays saying the tag phrase, what's the phrase they use? We're the world's radio station. You know, and in the current situation, there's some factual backing for that presentational touting claim. People all across Europe and the rest of the world have indeed been turning to the BBC, and in Russia too, importantly. It's extraordinary there. The audience has gone up an astonishing 252% to nearly 500,000 people. I mean, that was true as I was thinking about this yesterday and checking the number. Today, however, Russia has now put the block completely on the BBC output in over Russian territory. And I guess no surprise there. Two instances of the radio medium in particular producing standout examples of journalism during war came up this week, and I want to mention them in particular. They were doing what radio does best, I think, getting to the beating human heart of a story. And this story really needs that kind of illustrative, pointed reporting. Sarah Montague, who hosts the national midday broadcast in Britain, The World at War, and it's actually on the domestic UK service, but this item that I'm thinking about was quite rightly carried also on the world service several times over. She got put through to the cell phone of a Ukrainian father fleeing in his car with his children in the car with him, escaping the then threatened southern area of Kherson and the Melitopol in southern Ukraine. Where was he heading? Well, he hadn't decided. Perhaps he was going to neighboring Moldova, he said, where he had some connections, or maybe Romania. Montague even got some contributions from the man's 8-year-old daughter. And there was a telling piece of actuality broadcasting down the phone line when they were stopped by a military checkpoint. They're all very real. That's, as I say, that's the sort of thing that radio can capture so well. There was another telling piece of original reporting came when a Moscow-based correspondent, maybe Jenny Hill, who was previously in Berlin, one of them anyway, traveled to Siberia and found the family and the surrounding community for a young Russian soldier who'd been captured by Ukrainian forces, one of the many who've been shown on television. Connecting with their family, but the BBC went the extra mile, many miles, in fact, to go to Siberia and find the village and the family. And the family, of course, had no idea that he'd been sent into action in Ukraine. It all brings out that sharp relief what it actually means to have a rampaging army come into your force, into your territory, and the force itself is often just a set of uninformed individuals, because many ordinary soldiers often are. They don't know what the overall picture is in which they're playing such a horrible, violent part themselves.
You know, as I look at the media coverage, you're right. I watch the BBC. I was sampling all the networks, but finally I turned off most of the networks. I watched the late-night version of CNN coverage, because they use BBC reporters, by the way, in that as well. And it's also not hosted in America. It's hosted over in Europe. What amazes me about the coverage, and this doesn't happen on all networks, especially the BBC, is how they use footage that they keep throwing up when they're talking about war footage. They use war footage from the Ukrainian war that could be from the first day to the seventh day, and they're talking about a story, and you see this footage, and I fear that most people think that the footage that they see is current footage, and it's not. That's one thing news networks in this country do all the time, which has always upset me. If you're going to show news footage, show it or explain it as when it happened, not over stories that are brand new stories.
Yeah, that's what I meant about even Deutsche Welle, whose standards are very high, falls into that same trap too. As I say, all 24-hour news coverage video, I mean, you know, on TV and of course online, they're stuck in this dreadful habit of just using it like a kind of wallpaper.
Yeah.
And as you say, without any identification for the date of that or the place, it seems relevant because, of course, it's active, it's moving, it's attention getting, but it's not informative, and it just contributes to the general sensation that you're in some incomprehensible morass of information, which of course you are if you're on the ground in a war. But the point of the media, I think, is to draw back and give you a wider context and a fuller understanding of individual events that are happening. That's the job. And of course, you know, some of the broad international coverage has been exemplary. But then, of course, it's much easier. For instance, international coverage generally has reflected the way in which Russia has been condemned almost unanimously by the rest of the world. Here in New York, the UN General Assembly voted an especially dramatic, lopsided vote, 141 countries to 5, deploring the Russian invasion. And even major countries off and on Russia's side of the UN, like China and India, decided to abstain. And even though smaller countries, but ones who were close and previously friendly to Russia, like, for example, Hungary and Serbia, joined the vote against their belligerent neighbor. So, you know, it's clear that that Russia is in a very small minority, a sad little group of four of its somewhat abject supporters voted with Russia to make the total of 5, but against 141. Now that's just reporting that straight bald fact provides very strong context for this entire contest. It's not a contest. I mean, we know that. I mean, the vote was lopsided, but the conduct of a war is clearly lopsided too. And yet, Ukraine is putting up an extraordinary resistance. The people of Ukraine, every bit as much as its armed forces. I should single out a headline for you, one that I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to read aloud, because it's actually in Ukrainian, but it's on the cover of Time magazine, a very striking cover, in which you see a dark background, the light in it could possibly be an explosion from a shell, but there's a very, I mean, photographically, it's an extraordinary piece of contrast, light and dark, and as I say, I'm not going to attempt to read the headline. It's in the Cyrillic alphabet, it's in the Ukrainian language, but in English, it means life will defeat death, and light will win over darkness. Those were words that President Volodymyr Zelensky used this week, just a few days ago, to the European Parliament. He was urging Europe to support him, as of course they are doing, in every way short of actual military intervention, boots on the ground, that is. And he was saying that if Europe did support him to the full, then life would defeat death, and light would win over darkness. The chances are, well, it's challenging. I'm not going to make any predictions, but it seems unlikely that there'll be a military defeat of the Russians on the ground, but it's certainly in every other way the odds are being stacked against Russia finally getting its way entirely. I'm always reluctant to try prediction, especially in a military context. But we are seeing the stage being set for, at the least, some accommodation finally being sorted out between Russia and its small but valiant neighbor. Talks have already happened, an agreement between them to establish humanitarian corridors. That's something, but we are clearly not seeing Russia being impelled to slow down or halt its advance in any way, except by the resistance of the Ukrainians themselves. Again, extraordinary images are coming out of people lying down and stopping the advance of Russian armored cars and the like. It's all very, very evocative of an unequal struggle in which, you can't help but feel that it's light versus dark here.
When you look at this, when I look at it, David, I don't know about you, I look at this in the long view, and what Vladimir Putin has done in the short term is try to prove his military strength and try to take back another region of the former USSR. I think that we will find in the long run that Russia will be in Ukraine for quite a while, like they were in Afghanistan and other areas, because big countries never learn that you really cannot put in regime change like this. But what he has done in the long term...
Well, you can, but sometimes the damage inflicted on yourself is so terrible that it is demonstrated to be a terrible mistake. That might be the outcome here.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The long view of this is that his reason for doing this was he didn't want to, he really wanted NATO, as most people during the 4 years Donald Trump was president, who criticized NATO. Well, what his long view should be now is that he's made NATO even stronger and more unified than they've ever been. He's made the EU stronger and more, even though more together than they have been in the years. And I think what he's done is shown that the EU and NATO will no longer allow Russia to push forward to the West and to invade countries that used to be portions of them. NATO has now become a major factor again and is strong again. And I don't think he had any idea in the world that that was going to happen.
Well, it's hard to know what he expected, but I think this is certainly not what he wanted. excuse me. The extraordinary unity of the rest of the world against this invasion, what the Russians themselves are insisting that their own media do not describe as a war, but of course it's a war. It is an invasion. It's an unequal invasion, an unjustified invasion. But in Russian official media, it's being called a military. They don't use the word limited, but that's the implication. It's a military operation. One huge effect of it, is the unity amongst European countries, and also internationally, globally. As I was indicating with the sheer numbers of the United Nations vote in the General Assembly, all suggests that it's it's what Joe Biden has been quick to describe as a miscalculation by Putin. Maybe that's true. And in the long run, as you say, he won't necessarily get exactly what he... I think you said it quite rightly about what his overall aim is here. From the Russian standpoint, NATO is a threat. The more member countries it gets moving in an easterly direction towards Russia, you can understand why a paranoid regime like Putin's would regard that as a threat. Now, whether the outcome overall is a stop to that movement is now up for question. There are countries in Europe who are not yet in NATO who now might feel that they really want to have the umbrella protection of NATO, given what the big Russian bear showed itself capable of. In the end, there are going to have to be talks, and some kind of agreement will be made. And I can imagine, almost any observer of the scene can imagine, I'm sure, that something along the lines of a limit, not necessarily a stated official limit put to future membership of NATO, but maybe also a suggestion that Russia's views would somehow be, to some degree, accommodated, and that overt threats like missiles close to Russia's borders would be limited in some way too. You can see a script developing, and there've been many times as diplomats have gone over the same territory again and again with Russia, but in these now heightened circumstances, it's possible to foresee something coming out of it that will end the advance of Russia. And although it'll be some time, I'm sure, before those Russian soldiers all find themselves not somewhere that they never wanted to be, but instead back in home barracks. And we'll have to wait and see, but I can imagine that scenario possibly developing.
People forget the original collapse of the Soviet Union, not Russia, but Soviet Union, was a combination of Ronald Reagan and his administration blowing up and just spending tons of money on defense, and Russia doing the same thing, spending tons of money on defense. And then all of a sudden, you had things that happened in the USSR that basically bankrupt the Russian government to operate the USSR, and they had a major change. And I look at this situation and I say it's not exactly the same, but once again, the West has far more economic wherewithal because they're united to prevent Russia now from building the USSR back. And that's what I can't believe that Vladimir Putin doesn't see, because he was there. He was, a member of Russian government. He saw the collapse of the USSR, and it was a financial collapse that led to all the disasters for them.
Yeah, his role was in the intelligence service, yep, in the Soviet Union's KGB, and he will have memories inevitably of one other element in that algebraic the equation that you were just laying out for the Soviet Union's troubles that led to the final collapse. Amongst them was very importantly the fact that Soviet Union, of course, at that point, had launched an invasion on another country, smaller, apparently easily overrun country. That's what the Russians thought. But rather like the British before them in the 19th century, they found that rolling over a small, less well-equipped and less well militarily organized country like Afghanistan, that's where it was, would be an easy matter for them, and it wasn't. And although they tried desperately to conceal the pictures and the information, it was another case of body bags coming back to the home country from a war front that demoralized the Russians' conduct of that war, and eventually they stopped. And they did more than stop that war. The ripples of that went through the country against the background of all the other things that were problematic for them that you just described. And eventually, yes, the Berlin Wall came down and the Iron Curtain went up. The Soviet Union collapsed. Now, I'm not, you know, historical parallels are always dangerous because they're not exact ever. Every situation is its own sui generis set of events. But you can see that Russia has clearly learned nothing from its fairly recent past. As you say, many countries just don't do that. They don't learn from the mistakes of history. But we do have that salutary reminder that Afghanistan played its part, that adventure, if you like, into another country was critical to the this destabilization of the Soviet Union. So who knows what the long-term effect of the Ukraine, I'm not going to call it an adventure this time, a foolhardy and undoubtedly unjustified and aggressive stance towards a much weaker neighbor. It may seem easy, but its long-term effects on the aggressor country could be every bit as bad as Afghanistan was to the Soviet Union.
David, it's always great to speak to you. We'll see where we stand next Friday in this ever-changing world with what's going on between the Soviet Union, the Ukraine, NATO, the European Union, and America. It's definitely going to lead to big changes in our world as we see it.
And we will keep up to date.
David, we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely.
David Terechuk with The Media Beat. David, of course, has his own website, themediabeat.us. You can also find David right here at Robin Hood Radio's website, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on The Media Beat with David Terechuk.